Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Nina Simone was born Eunice Kathleen Wayman in 1933 in a small town in North Carolina. She showed a gift for music at an early age with dreams of becoming a classical pianist. Instead, she made a name for herself with her distinctive voice, her politics, and her temperamental personality, both on and off the stage. Her memoir, I Put a Spell on You, was also the name of a song she recorded back in the 1960s. Let's listen.
I put a spell on you. Cause you're mine. Do, 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 do. You better stop the things you do. No, I can't stand it. You're running around. You know better, Daddy. I can't stand it 'cause you put me down. Yeah, yeah. I put a spell on you. Because you're
my guest, Nadine Cahotas, has written a biography of the self-described diva called Princess Noir, the tumultuous reign of Nina Simone, and she joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And Nadine Cahotas, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. And listening to her sing, I Put a Spell on You, what do you hear in her voice?
Oh, a sense of mystery, and I think you can pick up when she says, because you're mine, there's just that hint of anger, that hint of defiance, and certainly intensity. The other thing that's so interesting, this was clearly a studio recording, and yet with all the strings, the swooning violins, we can hear Nina cuts right through it to get her message across.
As a biographer, and I think I know the answer to this question, but I want to ask you anyway. As a biographer, what attracted you to Nina Simone?
It starts with the music, surely, but I had written a book about Dinah Washington that was a very absorbing challenge, and I've always been interested in the intersection of race and culture, and Nina felt to me like the next step. She's 9 years younger than Dinah, the next generation after Dinah's peers, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, and of course Billie Holiday, and here you have someone who, once she embraced the civil rights movement, was so engaged in that and how her art was tied to it in a different way from the women I mentioned before. And I thought that it was something worth exploring to get my arms around her story and her music and how the one influenced the other.
Did you ever see her perform?
Sadly, I did not. She came to Washington, where I live, at Constitution Hall in 2001, and I thought about going, and I didn't, and I regretted it. But fortunately, there's a good deal of footage of Nina, and I think there was nothing like her live.
Well, I wonder, too, what she, and this is not a fair question, but what she would have thought about someone writing a biographer of her, just sort of knowing how temperamental she was and knowing, you know, in certain ways, the difficulty of her life.
I have thought about that many
times
right from the beginning. And I was so fortunate to talk to her older siblings and her two younger siblings, and they were so wonderfully helpful, particularly her older brothers and sisters, in letting me try to get my arms around Polk County, North Carolina, Tryon. And I think there were moments where Nina would have thought, who are you? Who are you, you white person, you non-singer, to think that you can write about me? And then at other times, I was hoping that she might have appreciated the effort to get it right and to place in context the difficult moments that you have alluded to, so that we don't just point our finger at her and say, you know, this is just off the wall, but to try to understand it. So I I have decided in the best moments that she would have said, well, all right.
Fair enough. But let's talk about Polk County, where she was born. She was one of eight children. She was born Eunice Kathleen Wayman. Tell us a bit about her family, where she came from.
Yes, as you noted, she was one of eight children, almost in the middle, and a very proud family. Her father was so creative in so many endeavors. I loved learning about him, how he could fix cars. He had a dry cleaning business, and he took out a little ad in the Tryon Daily Bulletin that I use as the first chapter's title, Called For and Delivered, because right. to me it had that notion of religion, because her mother became an ordained Methodist minister, and in fact, the rest of the little world in Tryon got to see Eunice's talent accompanying her mother at churches. The other point, and I'll try to make this quickly, you know, having talked about the book on Dinah, she was from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and anybody who knows about the civil rights movement knows that Alabama and Mississippi in particular were harsh places where many important battles were fought. Tryon, North Carolina, is near Asheville, very different kind of place, a much more moderate place because it attracted so many northern art types. And I think that inured to Eunice's benefit. It was two white women who recognized her talent and wanted to make sure it was nourished and nurtured. I don't know that would have happened in the Mississippi Delta in 1933, 1940, 1945, as Eunice was 8, 9, 10 years old.
We're talking about a piano teacher that she had and a white patron, a woman who was a patron, really.
Yes, that's correct. And when I made three trips to Tryon, and one thing I wanted to do, and it was so illustrative, even though things had changed, we figured out where the Waymans' last house was before they moved to Philadelphia. And as you know, Nina has deep ties to Philadelphia.
Yes, indeed.
Parked the car with a friend who was helping me out, and we took the walk that 8-year-old Eunice would have done literally across the tracks from where her family lived in sort of the black section of town, but Tryon was really kind of a checkerboard, but literally across the tracks and then up to the hill to the poshiest part of the town, trying to imagine what was that like and what did she see, and then when she got to the other side and in a completely different world, and then being schooled by her teacher, Miss Mazzy, Muriel Mazanovich, into the world of Bach and Liszt and Chopin, and then at the end of the day to go back over and go accompany the church choir at St. Luke CME.
Well, you describe several incidents, each of them fascinating. One is that she did attend a segregated school, not surprising at this time and place, but that the principal actually paid someone to burn the school down.
Yes. Isn't that just the most telling,
yes,
the most telling vignette if you want to get a feel for how separate was not really equal? And I was very lucky that the Tryon Daily Bulletin and even the larger Asheville paper paid attention to this, and I really can't say anything more about the vignette except it speaks for itself that on the surface there is a benign atmosphere. This was not major Klan country. There weren't moments of harassment all the time in the obvious sense, but yet clearly when you went to the movies as a black family, first you could only go to special showings, then they let everybody come in, but you had to sit in the balcony, and it again is a vivid example of what segregation meant.
She was clearly a prodigy, a very gifted young musician. There also was a concert that she was asked to give, and her parents were actually kicked out of the concert, and she fought back.
Right. Kicked out of the front row.
Kicked out of the front row. But
right,
nonetheless, these were her parents. Yes.
That is right. And as Eunice tells it, and I have to say, I tried very hard to verify everything that I could from Nina's autobiography. And I was unable, I did find vignettes in the paper about Eunice Wayman and sometimes singing with her sisters as the Wayman sisters here and there. I could not pin down exactly when that was, but we don't doubt her. But she walked out on stage and just said, if you want me to play, my mother and father are going to have to sit right back down here where I can see them. And as far as we know, that happened. Mm-hmm. And one, at least where Nina put it in her autobiography, it was just an interesting coincidence. Her father was the founding treasurer of the Polk County NAACP. We don't know that the two things were tied together, but there it is.
Well, you mentioned Philadelphia, and she did apply to the Curtis Institute here in Philadelphia with I guess, dreams, aspirations of being a classical pianist.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, she had gotten a summer scholarship to Juilliard in 1950, and it was the six-week study at Juilliard that was in preparation for the auditions at the Curtis Institute. And it was a major, major blow when Eunice was rejected. And, you know, we'll never know why. The folks at Curtis were so helpful to me in trying to understand the audition process. And as I'm sure people in Philadelphia know, Curtis is so prestigious because it is small. And there are openings only in your discipline to keep the enrollment at a certain level. Eunice did end up studying with Vladimir Sokolov privately, hoping that she might be able to take the entrance exam, but it was through that accompanying job, the Arlene Smith Studio, that she ended up going to Atlantic City to make money, and that is the moment that we have the birth of Nina Simone.
Indeed, and I do want to get to that, but from her perspective, did she think she was rejected because she was Black?
I believe that's right. I think that's actually right, and if you want to refine it a little bit, and I think maybe Eunice has a point here and Nina has a point here. Mm. There were other Black graduates of Curtis, at least one is went on to win a Pulitzer Prize, but Eunice was disadvantaged from the moment she stepped forward if she was competing with white children from wealthier backgrounds who had had much more opportunity for more sophisticated training. So one could argue just by the fact of who she was and where she came from, she was at a disadvantage. There are others who will say, and someone in writing about the book said, you know, we should just fess up. Maybe she was good, she was great, she had some genius, but maybe she just wasn't that good.
Hmm.
But you know, we'll never know. If I could just add one thing, it's so clear from listening to her music that her feel and her love for classical music never left her. If you focus on some of the accompaniment rather than her vocals, I think you can't miss it.
In fact, we will do that after this very short break. We are going to take a break, and our guest is Nadine Cahotas. She's written a book about Nina Simone called Princess Noir, The Tumultuous Reign of Nina Simone. She also wrote a book called Queen, The Life and Music of Dinah Washington and Spinning Blues into Gold, The Chess Brothers and the History of Chess Records. And again, take a short break. We'll get back to our conversation to talk about the life and music of Nina Simone. And after this very short break, we're going to play Little Girl Blue. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY grows solar, installing solar power systems in Pennsylvania and nationwide, offering solar site evaluations and financing information at grosolar.com or 800-GO-SOLAR.
I'm Krista Tippett. Please join me on Tuesday, April 27th at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts. We'll explore Einstein's God and the fascinating interplay of questions, if not answers, that is emerging between 21st century science, medicine, theology, and philosophy. Call 215-893-1999 or visit whyy.org/member experience to get your tickets for this evening of ideas on April 27th. I'd love to see you there.
Supporting WHYY, Moore College of Art and Design, offering continuing education credit, non-credit, and certificate programs at their Center City campus. Programs include digital media for print and web, fashion studies, and interior design studies for men and women. Information about the continuing education open house on April 1st or spring classes can be found on the web at moore.edu or by phone 215-965-4030.
Support for WHYY is provided by the teachers and education support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, educating all children for a bright future. PSEA, the power of a great education.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and we're talking about the late musician Nina Simone, who wanted to stay outside of any conventional category. Her classical music training backed up her identity as a songwriter, jazz, blues, pop, and soul singer. She was misunderstood, as one of her famous recordings revealed. Well, writer Nadine Cahotas, our guest today on Radio Times, is helping us understand Simone's difficult life in her new biography called Princess Noir. Let me play a song. This is called Little Girl Blue. It goes back to the late 1950s. It's words and music by Rodgers and Hart. Simone is playing the European Christmas tune Good King Wenceslas under the Rodgers and Hart song. Let's listen. Nadine Cahotas, and again, it's such a beautiful song, and we hear her on the piano, this little girl playing the piano, and this woman singing.
Right, and haunting, really, isn't it? And also the intricacy there. But Nina herself said, and this was so helpful, Nina's own voice talking about it when she turned herself into Nina Simone, and perhaps we should tell folks that was because she knew that her mother would be so upset that her daughter was going to be earning money in a nightclub, even though the family was going to benefit, that before she got up the courage to tell her and knew she had to, she came up with a different name. And I think we also have to agree that Nina Simone is perhaps a bit catchier and looks better on the marquee than Eunice Wayman did anyway. What we hear here is what Nina said, that she realized her voice was actually of limited range, not like someone, Sarah Vaughan, who could go low and go way high and all of it crystal clear and beautiful, so that her voice, she considered a third element. Her left hand and her right hand were going to carry it, and she would be singing above it. And I think that this is a great example of how well that works together.
Well, let's understand even how Eunice Wayman became Nina Simone, and she picked the name Nina Simone for very specific reasons.
So it would seem, but once again, this was a little difficult to straighten out, and I thought that the best thing to do was to pick the version closest to the time that she became Nina Simone. She said at one point that she had a boyfriend who called her Nina. At another moment, she said she liked the name and she thought it kind of reminded her of Little Flower. And then she said, well, Simone just came out of nowhere. In a later interview, she said she really liked Simone Signoret. So it variations on a theme, there you are.
Well, and this was, she, as you said, she didn't want her parents, perhaps even her mother, finding out that she was singing in bars. And I guess where this all started was Atlantic City.
Yes, the Midtown, the Midtown Bar and Grill. And it was through one of the students that she was accompanying, who was also singing at the Arlene Smith studio, who said he was earning $90 a week in Atlantic City, which was a little better than Eunice was doing. So she got in touch with the person who had booked this student and went to the Midtown, and a man named Harry Stewart hired her. Mm-hmm. And one of my little eureka moments was going to Atlantic City, pulling the newspapers, and I reproduce one of them in the book. There is the ad in Nina's second season, you know, starring at the piano, Nina Simone. You know, not that I didn't think it wasn't true, but it was wonderful to see it.
So does that mean that she had early on success?
I think that's right. No one had ever really heard this amalgam of classical music sitting in a bar, and then hearing this interesting husky, dusky voice over the piano work. And as she said herself, and you got a sense of it just in Little Girl Blue, the way she could mix and match. I mean, these weren't just 2-3 minute little tunes. So she caught on immediately, as you suggested, and one way to tell that was to see how the adjectives in the ads for the Midtown got a little more superlative.
Did she ever have any professional training as a singer?
Not that I know of. Everything was what she had learned as a child singing in choirs. And then, as she tells it herself, while she was accompanying the students at the Smith studio, she would tell them, as she said, I would try to tell them what I thought they should do, that you have to have feeling. And if they didn't get it, then I would demonstrate myself. And, you know, they actually got it. And I could see I was actually enjoying this. I mean, these are Nina's own words.
But, you know, it's interesting, I always resist this idea of sort of trying to categorize people. And she clearly resisted that and seemed to have sort of an omnivorous love of certain kinds of songs.
That's right. And it also evolved after 1963, which is when Nina embraces the civil rights movement, and not only her music, but her look changes. But just to talk about the music first, you start out as a traditional jazz musician with a piano, a bass, a guitar, and the drums. And by the time you get to the late 60s and the 70s and later, there are African instruments, there are Middle Eastern influences, and an eclectic interest to be sure, and a shift in what you want the message to be, I think, both in the lyrics and the sound.
Well, I do want to get to that, but let me play another song performed by Nina Simone. This is the song is titled I Loves You, Porgy, but she changes it slightly as she sings it. This is from, again, the late 50s, words and music by George Gershwin, DuBose Hayward, and Ira Gershwin, and, of course, from the 1935 opera Porgy and Bess. Let's listen to Nina Simone singing I Love You, Porgy.
I love you, Porgy. Don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I wanna stay here with you forever. And I'll be so glad. Someday I know he's coming back to call on me. He's going to handle me and hold me so. It's gonna be like dying, Porgy, Daddy, deep inside me. But when he comes, I know I'll have to go. I love you, Porgy.
And again, Nina Simone, a George Gershwin and Ira Gershwin song. And talking today on Radio Times with Nadine Cahotas. She's written a book about Nina Simone called Princess Noir, The Tumultuous Reign of Nina Simone. We are talking about her life and playing selections of some of the songs that she performed during her career. And, you know, I was listening to that. She does not have a perfect voice, but it is so expressive.
Yes, it is. And if I may say, Nina has Philadelphia to thank for the success of Porgy. It was a Philadelphia DJ, Sid Mark, back at WHAT, who got the album. They got to know each other when Nina, very early in her career, was playing one of the rooms at the Rittenhouse Hotel. He loved Porgy and started to play it over and over again, and that was her first time on the charts. So a deep, deep Philadelphia connection to that song.
I'm intrigued that she just slightly changed how she sang it. It's not "I loves you, Porgy," but "I love you, Porgy."
Yes, she did clean that up, and I believe that she took it from Billie Holiday, and that was her introduction to Porgy. She talks about one of the friends she made while she was playing the Midtown, bringing over Billie Holiday's record, and that is where she started to perform it. You know, Nina was later, she had an evolving relationship with how she would sometimes be compared to Billie Holiday, but this is one moment where her interest in what Billie Holiday was doing served her very, very well.
In fact, she said, compare me to Maria Callas, not Billie Holiday.
That is correct. That is correct. I'm not jazz. I feel more in tune with opera.
But does that also tell us about how she thought about herself as a singer-performer?
I think so. You used one of the words earlier, diva, and yeah. I think that there were moments when Nina wanted deeply to be respected, and actually I use that word for one of the chapter titles as well. It was not just in terms of what kind of recording contract she should have, but also she insisted on decorum in clubs, and there's more than one incident where she simply left a booking. She just said, if you're going to talk, I'm not going to play.
Well,
period.
Indeed, and some of them are almost jaw-dropping in what she both says to the audience and what she does.
Yes, that is correct. And later on in her career, and we're in the 70s, some of those moments are actually painful, and you can imagine what it must have been like to be there. And there is a tinge of being out of control. And there, I think, is where one has to step back and realize that there were moments when there was illness operating, not just an excessive amount of pride, but a kind of out of control that is not comfortable for anybody, performer or audience.
Do you have a diagnosis, you think, for Nina Simone?
The best I could do was what others said to me, that perhaps a bipolar issue, that by the 80s when she saw medical people and had medication, it helped her be on a more even keel. But it was difficult to be completely specific about this without precise medical records. And then I thought to myself, too, we really care about Nina, don't we, because of the music she left behind and what she represented, in particular at a certain time, this unapologetic rage at the condition of her people, African-Americans, in a particular time in the country, and her contribution to helping us understand why one might be angry.
Well, and this gets a little bit ahead of the story, but you mentioned one of these concerts where she really went ballistic, and this was actually at Cannes, where she says to the audience, "I'm a genius. I'm not your clown. Most of you people out there are crooks. I'm an artist, not an entertainer. The five record companies owe me money." I mean, this was a woman who was mad at the world, it seemed, at least at this point in her life.
Yes, that is correct. And in that moment, it was so fortunate that Nina's good friend James Baldwin, the writer, happened to be in the audience. And I found these moments so moving. And there's actually a photograph in the book from another moment that happened in New York. He came up on stage at Cannes and just did perhaps the only thing you could do. He put his arms around her and said something to her. We don't know what, but it was comforting, and it got her back on track so that she could finish. And then she finally left the stage, although she did hurl one last insult on her way out. Mm-hmm. It was a difficult moment.
Well, and I do want to get to some of the music that she performed that was just wonderfully and profoundly political. But I also want to understand and make sure our audience understands she had several marriages, and again, these seem tumultuous, complicated relationships.
Two, actually. And it's so interesting for the Nina Simone we came to know in the midst of the civil rights movement that her first husband was a white man whom she met at the Midtown, a man named Don Ross. He was... sometimes he said he was a drummer, a painter. He was a salesman who would hire himself out to go up and down the East Coast as was necessary. But as Nina described it, he paid attention to her. And there's a constant theme of loneliness that Nina talked about in her own autobiography and also in interviews that she gave along the way that I was able to find, that we simply have to believe that all the success could not fill up what was a worry, a concern about self underneath. And the other side of that for us is that I think that's what you hear in some of the music and even in the couple of tracks you've played already, a hauntedness in this. And her second marriage was to Andy Stroud, whom she met in New York. And for a while, that's when her career was really, Andy took care of a lot of things, managed the band and kept things going, and that lasted roughly 7 years.
It did not, though, get off to a good start, to say the least.
Nina writes in her autobiography that while they were engaged, there was just an almost unbelievable incident where she said Andy was jealous that she had received a note from someone, and he struck her repeatedly, and she finally got away and wondered if she should marry him. But they resolved all of that, and indeed it does lead one to wonder why they got married at all. Mm-hmm. But in fact they did, and there were moments when you see photographs of them and their very nice house in Mount Vernon, New York, and they had a daughter, Lisa, who now performs as Simone. They look like any conventional couple. And there was a moment in the mid-60s when family and career seemed to be just exactly on a traditional track that you would hope for.
And we're almost up in a break here, but I ran across a record producer saying about working with Nina Simone. He said, working with her was like sitting next to a keg of dynamite.
Yes, Stu Phillips,
right. Just, I guess, because you never knew which Nina Simone was going to show up?
I think that's right. And a later producer, Dave Matthews, actually, he was the arranger when Nina made the record Baltimore, said there was, they were ready to throw up their hands. And finally, Nina got down to business and came in the studio and in 1 hour did these wonderful vocals. And he said, that's why we're doing this album.
Well, let's take that break. We'll get back to our conversation and back to some more music as well. Nadine Kohoutis is our guest today on Radio Times, and her new book is a biography. It's called Princess Noir, The Tumultuous Reign of Nina Simone. We are learning about her life and playing music from some of her concerts and recordings. Do stay with us. We're going to play Mississippi Goddamn after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Lovers of arts and culture programming know that WHYY is the place to find something stimulating, enlightening, and new. Starting April 2nd, Friday Arts comes to WHYY-TV and WHYY.org. Discover the work of artists of all ages and backgrounds, enriching the world in our own backyard. A closer look at local creative minds is coming. Friday Arts, April 2nd at 8:30 on WHYY-TV.
Supporting WHYY, Widener University presents the Philadelphia Speaker Series in its seventh season at the Kimmel Center, featuring columnist Thomas Friedman, Eat, Pray, Love author Elizabeth Gilbert, pediatric neurosurgeon Ben Carson, columnist Peggy Noonan, former South African President F.W. de Klerk, political commentator Mark Shields, and a face-off with Karl Rove versus Howard Dean. Seven evenings at the Kimmel Center, designed to enlighten and entertain you. Tickets at PhiladelphiaSpeakerSeries.org.
People love their pets. They offer companionship, a listening ear, and unconditional love.
They bring me a lot of joy. They jump up on me when I get home. It's just a warm feeling because even if you had a bad day, they're still happy to see you.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. On the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk about our pets, what they mean to our mental and physical well-being. That's today at noon, right here on WHYY FM. How much is
that? This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Nadine Cahotas about her new biography called Princess Noir, The Tumultuous Reign of Nina Simone. And Nadine Cahotas has also written a book called Queen, The Life and Music of Dinah Washington and Spinning Blues into Gold, The Chess Brothers and the History of Chess Records. Well, let me play another song, and this one actually performed by Nina Simone, but also written and composed by Nina Simone. This goes back to the early 1960s, and it's called Mississippi Goddamn. Let's listen.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn. And I mean every word of it. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. This is a show tune, but the show hasn't been written for it yet. Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in jail, black cat cross my path, I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on this land of mine, we all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there, I've even stopped believing in prayer.
And that's Mississippi Goddamn, performed by Nina Simone, words and music also by Nina Simone. And Nadine Cahotas, again, another really powerful song.
Yes, this song marks the beginning of Nina's engagement in the civil rights movement. It was written in 1963, that terrible September morning when the 16th Street Baptist Church was bombed in Birmingham, Alabama, and four little girls who were preparing to lead the Sunday service were killed. Nina was at home in Mount Vernon and heard the news, and as she said, she was just so enraged that she didn't know what to do. She thought about doing something violent, and Andy reminded her that that was really not the way to go, and what she had was her music, and in very short order, out came this song.
And really using the stage as a political platform, a platform for civil rights.
Yes, that's right. And if I could, I'd like to give a plug to one of your local papers. 2 years later, Nina was among the many musicians who went down to Montgomery, Alabama, after the marchers finally got clearance to make that walk from Selma to Montgomery. We're talking March 1965 now, to present their demands to then-Governor George Wallace. There is a wonderful photo of Nina with John John Lewis, the March 30th, 1965 Philadelphia Tribune. And there's actually a little bit of footage of her performing Mississippi Goddam. But to any of your listeners who might want to go to the library, if we could have gotten a clearer print, I would have loved to use it. But you can just imagine that scene, Nina, in Montgomery, Alabama, singing to these marchers who have finally, after a week of legal wrangling and getting protection, first having been beaten trying to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and she comes down and says, Alabama's got me so upset, Tennessee made me lose my rest. Yeah. And an extraordinary moment.
Well, you know, it's interesting listening to that music, and she even says it halfway through, that it does sound almost like, you know, the Music Man or something in the beginning, and then it takes this darker turn.
That is exactly right. I thought the very same thing when I listened to it, and there are many different versions when you hear Nina sing it in later life. I actually thought that was a good song to take the temperature of where she was, in the first instance vocally, because then, you know, 20 years down the road, you know, she shifts downward a little bit, and her introduction to it later 65, she changes one of the lines and says, Watts made me lose my rest to be a current. At another point, she sings, St. Augustine made me lose my rest. And these, of course, are allusions to the latest battles on the civil rights front. But I think what makes it so interesting, it's not anthemic like We Shall Overcome, but it does have this show tune beat and then those biting lyrics.
Do you think that part of her rage was because of the Jim Crow South that she grew up in, the civil rights struggle of the, you know, 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s?
I do, and she says so herself. And if I could take one step back, we didn't talk about this before, but Nina herself talks about her deep and important friendships with Langston Hughes, with James Baldwin, and with Lorraine Hansberry, and credits Lorraine Hansberry with, as she said, understanding that I was part of the movement, whether I wanted to be or not. So if those are your close friends when you're in your early 20s and just making a name for yourself, I think it's going to help you understand your place in the world and how you might use your talent to further the struggle. And then, of course, there were the obvious facts of discrimination. You know, you have to walk here, you have to walk there, you can't come in this store, you have to buy your food and eat it out there. It is, I think, hard for us to understand from the outside how you absorb that and go on with your day.
Well, and I'm looking at a quote from Langston Hughes about Nina Simone. She is different. She was Billie Holiday, St. Francis, and John Donne. So was Mort Saul. So was Ernie Banks. And then he says, you either like her or you don't. If you don't, you won't. If you do, woo-wee, you do.
Exactly. And this, I believe, is 1959, just as Porgy hit. And as you look back on it now, what a wonderful thing to have Langston Hughes, a wonderful poet and a presence, devote one of his columns to talking about you, and that was syndicated all over the place.
Well, let me play another song, and this is performed by the person we're talking about, Nina Simone, today on Radio Times. It's a song called Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, and we know that the Animals also recorded this song, and there's a little interchange about that, which we will get to with our guest. But first, let's listen to Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, words and music by Horace Ott.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. You know, sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree with a joy that's hard to hide. Sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry, and then you're bound to see my other side. But I
never mean to take it out on you. Life has its problems, and I get more than my share, but that's one thing I never mean to do, 'cause I love you.
Again, Nina Simone singing Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood. And I keep saying the same thing to you, Nina, Nadine Cahotas, which is wow, after we listen to each of these songs. But
yes,
there's a fascinating story where she bumps into Eric Burdon of the Animals.
Right. He came back to say hello to her after a concert in New York, I think wanting to pay homage. And all she could think about is that, you know, you're the SOB who took my song away from you, because Nina recorded it. The Animals heard it. They made a recording. And that is the one that was a hit. And he was taken aback. But then he said, well, you know, we may have been influenced by you, but it's all over Europe and they're waiting for you. And she says, hello, I'm Nina Simone. Have a seat. And in fact, she did. She did go to Europe quite successfully. If I could just, you know, take a moment about
sure.
what we just listened to, you know, I think that the vocals are so wonderful there, and you hear that heavy-duty orchestration, and when you think of the Animals, you know, this doesn't have the bluesy muscle that they bring to it, but it's so evocative, isn't it? You can hear the pain and the hurt, and I would say, too, it there are floating around some live versions of this with Nina, and they're much more spare, but I promise you, you don't miss the violins and the backup that she brings it all. She brings it all home just by the vocals and what she has her backup musicians do. And I think everybody was trying to find the niche so that a record would be a good seller. But I think that we sometimes can enjoy Nina the best in the less busy settings.
Well, I would agree with that. And I do want to play another song. This is Go to Hell. And I wonder, could you set this up for us?
This is funny. She went through a period. You're talking about the song that says, "Well, you'll go to hell."
Yes,
yes. That would often be her opening number in the 1968 period. And her guitar player Henry Young, who was so wonderful to talk to, said, "You know, he thought that was quite a message to send to the audience that you know she was coming on stage and letting you know musically this evening was going to be or afternoon was going to be on her terms. You know, well, you'll go to hell." Most musicians might not start they're set that way.
But
she chose to do so.
Well, let's listen.
Your mind lies in the devil's workshop. Evil doing's your thrill. Trouble and mischief is all you live for. You know done well that you go to hell. You go to hell. So you're living high and mighty, rich off the fat of the land. Just don't dispose of your natural soul, 'cause you know done well that you'll go to hell. That you'll go to hell. Say hell where your natural soul burns. Hell where you pay for your sins. Hell keep your children from wrongdoing, 'cause you know done well that they'll go to hell. They'll go to hell. I say hell, man.
And again, Nina Simone, Go to Hell, and words and music by Nina Simone. And Nadine Cahotas, we have just a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye here, but do you see her as a tragic woman, a heroic woman, some combination of the two, or more than that?
Surely some combination of the two. Just listening here again with you, I think to myself, what wonderful music, what feeling, what emotion, how compelling. And I did find myself working on this really toward the end, moments of sadness that all this talent came with such anguish. The other side of that is how do we know how much of that fueled the music? Mm-hmm. Nina might not have been Nina without all the tumult that was going on inside. I think perhaps the most important thing, and it just made me smile, I think she would approve of the cut that you picked for the last part of the show, that she would be amused by that. Yes, please go ahead.
No, and I'm sorry to do this because we are out of time, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're
I appreciate
welcome.
It. No, thank you.
You're very welcome. And that's Nadine Cahotas. We've been talking about Nina Simone, and her book is called Princess Noir. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member-supported public media. And we close things out with I wish I knew how it feels to be free.
Chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart.